Hello, welcome back. We have in our previous lectures talked about contractual breach, contractual fulfillment. Then we talked about remedies. And now we're going to talk about what are your limitations on remedies. And we're then going to move in to our case tonight that you need to perform the contract to avoid the breach. And now we're going to talk about your limitations on remedies, your liability, and can you put things like liability clauses and liquidated damages clauses and attorney's fees in contracts so you limit your liability from the outset. Let's talk about it. First, let's talk about our definitions. Remember, repetition is the mother of learning. You're going to know this definition. I know you will. What is a contract? It's an agreement between two or more parties creating obligations that are enforceable or otherwise recognizable at law. The elements are an agreement between competent parties based on genuine assent, supported by consideration for a lawful purpose subject matter and in the form required by law. Now, once you have that contract, you got to perform it. If you don't, now we are into damages and remedies. But can you limit those damages from the start? Now, remember what a remedy is. It's the means of enforcing a right or preventing or redressing a wrong. You have damage remedies, which are expectation damages, reliance damages, and restitution. Remember that those are monetary damages. Then you have equitable relief, which is rescission, specific performance, injunction, and reformation. This is our remedies roadmap, which we've seen before. Now, can you take those damages? You know that if I'm unable to perform the contract, there's going to be damage. There's going to be pain. So can I limit what that is or specify the amount? The courts say yes. You can put into a contract something known as liquidated damages. So you could put a fixed amount. You can limit your damages by putting in a fixed amount. So you say, if I don't put in that pool by May 15th, you're going to get a damage customer of $200 a day for every day after May 15th. I don't have the pool in. And you can start that from the get-go saying, you know, maybe I won't be able to do it by May 15th, but if I don't get it done by the day, I got to pay you $200 for every day I don't do that. Now, my daughter bought a home in Austin, Texas, and the previous people had the home and wanted to rent it back from my daughter before she was able to move in because they didn't want to leave it right away. And she turned to me, who's an attorney, my daughter's a lawyer, and she said, Dad, what should I do on this to get them to move out? Because, you know, I don't want to just keep running it to them because I have an opportunity cost. You know, I got to find another place to live in the meantime, so on and so forth. I said, well, put in a liquidated damages clause. I said, put in the clause that for every day that they stay after X day, say you'll rent it back to them for, you know, a month or 2 months or whatever is comfortable for you. And that every day after that, they have to pay twice your amount of your mortgage. And guess what? They moved out on the day that they had to move out. Why? Because they didn't want to pay that extra penalty. Liquidated damages clauses are very good, but they are only great when you can understand what the amount of the exposure is going to be and willing to do that to go into that contract. The validity of a liquidated damages clause is based upon the facts. When the clause was written, can the situation be overcome by money? And is the amount specified excessive? Because if it's viewed as excessive, then the court won't uphold it. The effect of that party liquidated damages clause will allow the parties to know what they're going to get in the event of a breach. It allows you to have experience with the contract where you know that the contract's going to go forward, and you know that if it doesn't the way that the contract expressly states, you're going to get some kind of recovery. You don't have to go into court for this. That's a nice thing, unless somebody challenges it. And generally they don't. That's why they put in the liquidated damages clause, is to prevent a court fight. That's the whole purpose of it. And if you end up going to court, you can get this damage thing. Even without going to court, you generally get the liquidated damages amount, because that is right directly within the four corners of the contract. Now, when won't this liquidated damages clause be upheld? As we said, if it's unreasonable, I mean, if it's so huge, say, you know, you don't put in the pool by May 15th, you got to pay me $300 million. Well, nobody's going to do that. Okay. And as a result of that, you know, it's got to be a reasonable amount, and it's got to somewhat relate to the actual damages that a person would suffer. Liquidated damages clauses are great. They prevent litigation, and they, more importantly, they promote performance, because people generally don't want to pay them. Okay. What about attorney's fees? When can you get attorney's fees? Generally, only when it's written into the contract. Attorney's fees are routinely awarded under English law, but in American law, attorney's fees only happen in two cases. When you sue, you generally don't get recovery for the cost of paying your attorney, unless it's in the contract. If the contract provides for attorney's fees, then you can get them. Or if certain statutes provide for the recovery, and they're generally consumer statutes, provide for the recovery of attorney's fees, then you can get it by statute. To give you an example, civil rights actions. If you fire me because I'm a Catholic, you fire me because I'm an African American, I sue you, I get attorney's fees for that. Why? Because the statute, which provides for that cause of action, Federal Civil Rights Law, 1983, provides for attorney's fees. If you don't have that in the law, you're not going to get it. The state human rights law also has a similar provision under the state executive law. So you get under those statutes, certain provisions under the general business law in New York State provide for attorney's fees. Why? They're consumer protection statutes. And they say, hey, if I have to sue that big bad company, I'm going to get attorney's fees for having to do that. If it's in the contract, you get it pursuant to the contract, but you got to write it in the contract, and they got to agree to it that they'll pay the attorney's fees. Writing it in a contract is a good idea, because one of the biggest expenses in litigation is attorney's fees, and the other side doesn't want to pay them. So as a result of that, that is always a good idea to write it in your contract if you can, but if it's not in the contract, you don't get it. Now, court costs and fees are recoverable. Why? Because of the fact that they are viewed as part of going to court. Not hiring a lawyer, which is broadly within your discretion. Everyone who goes to court has to pay these court costs and fees. You know, the RJI number, the index number, the filing fee cost, and sometimes you have motion costs that you have to pay to the court for doing that. They are vastly less than attorney's fees. You know, they're hundreds of dollars instead of sometimes millions of dollars, depending on what kind of action you have. Now, why is the American rule, as opposed to the British rule, that we don't have attorney's fees unless it is in the contract or unless the statutory provision allows for it? Because we want to encourage people who have been wronged to go to court. And if you have to pay the other party's attorney's fees when you lose, which is the British system, you're going to be less likely to bring an action in court. We in this country have decided that we want to encourage people to litigate. There's a big debate of whether or not that's a great idea. Some people like the British system, some people don't. But at the end of the day, if you want that British system, put it in the contract, because you always can. Okay. What about limitation of liability clauses in a contract? You can put in a contract that there is a limitation of liability. I won't pay more than $1 million in damages, for example. But these limitation of liability clauses are looked upon with very circumspect eyes of the court. They're looked upon frequently as being unconscionable, depending on the way they're written. They have to be reasonable. Now, when they're between parties of a commercial nature, you know, two companies put this in, they're much more likely to be upheld. But when it is a company and a consumer, for example, frequently they won't be upheld. You know, when you pull in the parking garage, it says not responsible for any loss or damage to your vehicle. Well, if the guy who's parking your car slams it into a concrete wall and damages it, that limitation of liability is not going to be effective, because the court is going to turn around and say, hey, look, that's not reasonable. You're not two arm's length transactions when you turn over your keys to somebody in that contract for that to park the car. You're expecting them to handle it with reasonable care. Now, you know, when the parking garage, sadly, in 1993 was blown up in the World Trade Center. This is the first World Trade Center attack. Before, sadly, it was attacked in 2001. All those cars were damaged in that parking garage, because the parking garage, several floors of it were blown out. And as a result of that, there was a limitation of liability, because people didn't think that that was going to happen. And it was a event that was clearly exculpatory of the parking garage. So they were limited for their liability. They didn't have no liability. They just limited the liability, as opposed to the bad parking attendant who slams your car into the wall. Okay. So particularly when it is amongst arm's length transactions, big parties, you know, Walmart sues Chase Manhattan Bank, there could be a limited liability clause in that relationship. When it's generally between a individual party, such as a consumer and a big company, they're not going to be upheld, okay? Now, a limitation on liability clause is different than a release. Generally, people who are involved in litigation, when it's concluded, sign a release saying, I'll never sue you again for this instance. Those are routinely upheld. That is a contract saying, I'm going to pay you X amount of damages, so we have a settlement in this action. And rather than going through a trial and a court case, I'm going to just settle it, and we agree on paying $50,000 in damages. In return for getting that $50,000, the defendant requires the plaintiff to sign a release saying, I'm going to pay you this $50,000, but you're not going to sue me again tomorrow on this in a new action, because the statute of limitations hasn't run and you can sue me again. Well, I make you sign a release saying, for this kind of injury that you sustained on this date, you're never going to sue me again. That's a release, and that is valid. Okay, that's it on the effect of breaches on damages and on the limitation on liability. We're next going to venture into our case, which is an interesting case. Neuberger v. Leibel. It came out of the Great Depression. It's a rather sad case. We'll see you next time to talk about it. Thanks so much.